Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, so it's 48 degrees outside. It's about 2:22 in the morning. My computer is rendering a bunch of architectural stuff, so I am just chilling right now. I thought it might be a good idea to change the subject from our normal stuff. And of course, you know, there's some go-to subjects we can deal with here. And I thought, you know, I've been watching Mandalorian. And Favreau, who's written this thing and created it, is just doing, so far, a brilliant job. And it just reminds me, like, he and I write very similarly in that simplicity rules when you write classic scripts. And I'm just going to go through it because, you know, I've done, gosh, what, 8 episodes on screenwriting. Now, let me put this little thing to you. Let's just say you're looking at this episode, oh my God, it's screenwriting, whatever. I want you to realize that this particular episode might actually appeal to you because instead of getting into screenwriting or book writing or whatever you do, because this will apply to whatever you're doing, but definitely for the screen. Because I think I'm going to call this one like Simple Foundations or something like that. I don't know yet. This is going to break screenwriting down and storytelling down in a way that hopefully, even if you have no experience, your brain's going to have no problem tracking all the pieces and parts. So, I'm going to use Star Wars a lot in this particular analogy, at least at first. And then we're going to branch off after that. When I watched the last 3 Star Wars movies that were made, and then I watched a bunch of the critiques online, which were extremely accurate, what people seemed to be missing in their explanation, and I found Game of Thrones broke this rule. I mean, they're laughing all the way to the bank. I get it. But whatever audience they did get, they could have probably doubled and tripled their audience, hence their money. And so if you hit at least a critical audience and you're happy with the money that you make, it's great. But if you're a studio or an agency that's going to take part of the cut, it's probably a really, really good idea to expand your horizons without pandering socially. Because when we get inside these demographic conversations at studios, it's always about engaging the individual personalities and not looking at the overall hurdles that it takes the mind to understand the script. What am I talking about? Well, they'll make sure that all races are represented. They'll make sure that every orientation is represented, every age bracket is represented, so on and so forth. And there's really nothing wrong with that if you can make it work. But you don't want to be disingenuous to whatever story you're telling just to hit the demographic. And let's just say you come up with a really good combination of those particular elements. And the story seems like it works with those elements, you know? And then you write an over-complex script. And then the movie is watched. Nobody understood what the heck was going on. They don't recommend the film. And, you know, all these individuals go back and do postmortems, and they're like, well, what happened, man? I don't know. I don't know what happened. Now, a lot of times right now, scripts are just bad. They are. They're not even copycats of good old scripts. They're just absolutely incomplete things. And I'm not sure I'm going to address that in this unless we're doing a little, unless we have time left, let's put it that way. But to get back to our core theme of this particular episode. If you were to watch the old movie Amadeus, I think in the 80s, there was an assertion and a realization that was passed on to the audience that when Mozart went in and played for the king, he played so complex that the king said, there's too many notes in your music. And he walks off and he doesn't like the performance. And of course, Mozart's on the edge of absolute music creation at the time. having listened to all the greats, having been able to compose, what is a symphony at 7 years old or something like that, right? So by the time he was of age to play for the king, in a personal sense, which I don't know if that ever actually occurred, he was double, triple what's going on. So it is not, it's not a complete sin to make a complex script, but there are ways of making complex scripts that have a certain heartbeat such that the complexity has space between the turns to get you to your end. And what does that mean? You just need to space things out a little bit in time, and you can still maintain a fairly simple algorithm for the mind and hence, and thus keep everyone on track. But let's take any one of the latest Star Wars films, and then let's take Mandalorian, and then let's take the original OG Star Wars 4, 5, and 6. Now, I happen to think that the new Star Wars movies were uninteresting and horribly founded on the original movies. I just do. A kid wearing a mask for no reason whatsoever, just because his grandfather wore a mask. No one got the sense to write in an injury to him. Maybe even the emperor grabbing the grandson and damaging him and thus making him dependent on the emperor for breathing and a heartbeat and a brain. Thus, a new outfit. But the first Star Wars is so extremely simple. And there's a few categories of simplicity that we're going to go through in this particular episode. One of them is to remember back in the day, before cell phones and pagers screwed up all of our phone numbers, if you lived in a town, again, if you lived in big cities, this may not have been true for you, but I lived in the Midwest where a person's phone number was 7 digits. And I don't know if this is true, but I remember being told for nearly 2 decades when I was young that the phone companies decided that 7 digits was a natural socket capacity of the human mind. To add an 8th digit makes it cross the threshold of man being able to go, you know, that's her number, that's his number, that's my number, whatever. So just keep that in the back of your head when we're counting up how many elements an individual has to memorize. There's a lot of Pavlovian elements to the human mind that also finds comfort in a limited number of things. First things first, the character count. Now, for any of you that have ever been in a crowd and you had a really, really good time, then you might think, well, I'm not sure I believe what you're about to say. But I want you to distinguish an event from a constant way of living. You might go to a concert with a bunch of people, and you love the music, and they love the music, and so you feel like you're with your own kind, and you're having a great time. You may even go to the movie theater, and it has, you know, 300 people in it, and the more people, the better. Those are events, and we like that because we're in like-mind situations. But that doesn't have anything to do with a movie that feels like a crowd of people. Game of Thrones felt like a crowd of people. The latest Star Wars movies just cross that line of comfort at times when the very critical information is being dropped. It got a little busy for the mind. When you are at home with your 5 or 6 friends and you're throwing a little party and you have an intimate relationship on a different level with each one of these people. One person is your cousin, one person is your best friend from grade school, the other one's a college friend, and the other one's an associate from work. You will have shared, potentially, all kinds of wild experiences. For the kid that was your grade school friend, well, you puked on the spin-around ride at the playground. For your college friend, you got drunk and you held her head before, you know, while she was puking. That sort of thing. Your cousin, well, they know all your family secrets. You see how this is going. At work, it's your friend where you actually accomplished something and did something amazing. You finished a product, made a bunch of money for the company. But if I kept going and going and going and going, then it starts get starts to get to be a problem. And I'm going to use a party as an example so that you can understand the economy of time in a script. How many of you have held a party, invited so many friends that by the time the party was over, you realized you only talked to half the folks? If you managed to talk to the other half, you realized by the end of the night, there wasn't enough time to have a decent conversation. And then maybe if you're very empathetic, you're a little worried about, did they think I ignored them? Oh, crap, I should send them a text, give them a call, hold another event and invite that other half. Same thing goes for a film. Too many characters in your film, you don't have enough time to develop their origin, to develop their personality, to really get to their character traits unless you're an advanced writer. Star Wars, A New Hope, released in 1977, had a very small cast, had a very limited amount of locations. Tatooine, the Death Star. Right in the middle, you had the Millennium Falcon itself. In Tatooine, you got Aunt Beru and Uncle Owen, and you got the cantina, and you've got Obi-Wan's crib. Okay. Inside the Death Star, well, you got some hallways, some corridors, a little precipice to swing across, the landing bay. But overall, you consider in your brain typically a overall location like a home that you might visit. I went to my buddy's house today. He showed me the basement where he has his man cave. He showed me his theater room. He showed me the kitchen and living room, family room. But still in the mind, it's one location. So it really helps out. There are films that are written by masters that have a lot of locations. But those films have very special crews writing those films. And I would just simply say, oh, something just broke. When in Mission Impossible, you've got Tom Cruise and his crew for that particular film bouncing all over the world. They still keep it pretty well paced. Long establishing shots so you can figure out where you are. But what they do is they actually focus on the character so much that the rest is just decoration. Mandalorian appears to be copying the simplicity of the first three films. And it is going down like a fine liqueur, man. People are watching this. Everyone can get into it. It's become a bit of a monster movie thing recently with the first two episodes. I won't ruin anything for you. But it is advancing slowly, a narrative. It needs to become a year-round show, to be honest. 10 episodes a year is torturous for this universe. And perhaps it will expand at some point in time. But I'm sitting in my smoke lounge and we watched the first episode of season two. And one of the guys in the room was like, man, do you like the way this is going? Because it just seems like nothing happened. And what I believe is going on in his mind is that he's detoxing out of the films that just came out, which are just crack fests. I mean, it's sort of Michael Bay meets Star Wars. Very little story substance, lots of special effects. When they really want to have something emotional occur, which I think Michael Bay does a much better job doing, it's always a stretch because none of the characters are developed really well. So when I write a film, what I typically do is try to pick out a very small group of protagonists and a very small group of antagonists. So you got the key characters, the good guy and the bad guy, or good person, bad person, and then you surround them with their little posse. And then I try to come up with a movement as to where they're going to be in the script and really lock down the locations and repeat them at a pace that will hopefully feel like the iPod has been scrambled properly. Meaning, not too much in one location. I mean, if you have a very eccentric film, if you're running like the Gen game, well, it's all going to be in one room. But if that's a stage play converted to sort of a theatrical airing. For two old people play gin every single day. There's only one set. But here's what you gain. You gain many, many things by creating a very simplistic approach to your script. One, it's less moving parts to get your script put together. Two, the more that you analyze even inside your own mind a particular set, what I find, one of my rituals is when I get done with the script, I polish it, you know, get all the bugs out of it. I read it out loud to myself, making sure my words don't trip on the tongue, because you'll write things that are difficult to say out loud. And once you do that, you've got to rework it. Then I read it to at least one of my friends. I typically read to females because I think, you know, the other dimension I want to make sure I'm hitting is the female dimension, because I'm pretty sure I hit the male dimension. The male, what would attract a male to the film? If I get a raving thumbs up from a female, then I feel very comfortable about at least the foundation of what I've written. But let's just say you had four locations, four primary locations. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to cancel car rides. We're going to cancel maybe a convenience store or something like that where the character ends up. But as I read my setting description of the room, one of the things I have discovered over the years is that I will do my best to write really funny, exciting, engaging, gripping sentences, you know, 3 to 4 sentences to describe a particular set that we're in. But when I'm reading it to someone, I will immediately find out whether or not I've written enough, because what'll end up happening is I will read what I wrote down, and then I look at the person's face to see how well they're responding to the set. Like, I've just wrote a comedy, so the comedy should make them kind of go, oh yeah, I know that type of room. Yeah. And then if I'm not getting that response, I'll start embellishing live, writing out of my head. Oh, well, you know, it has this. Oh, yeah, that's funny. And then I realize, wow, it's not on paper. So whoever I give the script to is never going to know that extra piece. And so I'm making notes. But if I had 12 locations, my ability to go in and perfect all 12 locations to really bring out the essence of why is a particular scene set in a particular location, that's an extremely important choice. Why? It's very important. Scene locations are just as important as the conversation of where you're going to get married, where you're going to move your family to live for a decade. We don't just hodgepodge these things together, do we? We pick good locations, and there's all kinds of attributes of a location that makes us like that location. It has to be gripping. Either it's an endearing setting, or maybe it's a horrific setting, maybe it's an eerie setting. Whatever emotion you want to give a person, that setting that you choose, that location that you choose, should perfectly complement the overall tone of your script at that point. And just to put a little more detail in this, if you really want to understand the masters of the world, you'll go and subscribe to the YouTube channel Cinema Tyler. T-Y-L-E-R. This dude breaks it down, and you watch all of his analysis of Stanley Kubrick. He gets Stanley on a huge level. What this dude will break down for you in each one of the films that he covers is the overall... He finds out, too. He finds out interviews that you've never heard Stanley ever give, and he'll find out the sort of the footnotes either from the staff that's still alive or Stanley when he was alive about the color choices, the sound choices, his lens choices makes a huge difference. The perspective of the camera on the character, like what angle did he shoot it at? And this can result in tools that you can use when you're crafting your world. What I want for you when you write a screenplay or a story of any kind, especially if you write novels, right? What's the difference between a screenplay and a novel? Well, a novel, you can go on forever and ever and ever. Screenplay is your next stage up. It's where you're super disciplined and everything that you're writing is a visual thing. But you can note, you know, audio if you can make it make sense. Is there a lot of light? No light. Are there stripes that symbolize bars like Casablanca? Casablanca was full of overhead lighting that shot through grates and beams and things, such that the characters were always encased in bars. Or someone wore the woman, I believe, at the market when she's trying to buy silk, and it was Humphrey Bogart's character coming over to say hello for the first time to Ingrid Bergman. They being former lovers, and she skipped out on him in Paris, didn't show up to the train. She's wearing a black and white striped dress, if I remember right. And that is sort of being held prisoner in Casablanca. And the whole premise of that movie is the basis of her and her husband who show up to his place, Rick's place, as they're trying to get passage out of Casablanca to get out of German-occupied territory. So you have this imagery system that you can put into a particular setting. Now, if you had 12 things to do, 12 pieces of art to create, and each one of these things needs to be so engaging that it's going to grip an agent reading your script, then you know it's going to be hot. If you're asking the agent to remember 12 sets, you've crossed the threshold. Unless that agent is autistic, they're not going to remember everything. And thus, the impact of what you've written is less comforting because you're always changing where you are. Imagine that you went to 12 separate locations in a particular day and you're not a UPS driver or something. You had 12 meetings that you had to go to sell a product or something. It's, you know, it's always that unnerving first time. Where do you park? How do you get in this place? Do I get validated or not? Do I need to eat some food? Where do I go? It's nerve-wracking. And believe me, when you read a script, it can feel exactly the same. But what happens when you have a nice little loop that you're very, very used to in your local area? Well, I go to that bar or that bar. I go to that pool bar. I go to that one grocery store. This is my drugstore. And then I come home. My buddy's house. My other buddy's house. That's it. It's done. There's all the places I go on an average day, let's just say. Well, as soon as you walk into places that you like, because you've selected them out of all your choices, there's sort of a warm fuzzy. For any of you that, you know, visit your old hometown, there's all kinds of warm fuzzies when you go down old streets. You want the audience to feel that, unless you're trying to go for like a horror story. But even The Shining, think about it. There was the lobby, the writing room, the hallways, which all kind of combined into one scenario, and then their apartment. And the one place that was terrifying was the room 237 down the hallway, which was held back and described as this place you shouldn't go. And when Jack goes to see what might have hurt his child, we get the huge payoff of that room. We got the maze outside. There are not that many sets. 2001 A Space Odyssey, which is nearly, it was a little over 3 hours long. There's not much. There's the prehistoric man set, which is the waterhole and where they live. When they're on the spaceship, the Jupiter spaceship, well, there's the round room or the circular Ferris wheel room where Frank and Dave run. There's the EVA pod. And that's about it. And maybe in the pod. Very simple. So by reducing your sets, you get more time to describe things. And when you come back to those sets, you can actually transform them a little bit to give more meaning. Or like in Star Wars, New Hope. He comes back to his aunt and his uncle, and they've been slaughtered by the Imperial forces, which was a gnarly-ass scene for 1977. And I rewatched that the other day, and their skeletons are all over the ground, burned up. It was very vivid, very amazing. The new movies? Well, there's so many locations that they go to in a single film. You don't know where the hell you are. You may think they're neat looking and you may like the scenes in those areas, but if I said, here's a piece of paper, draw me this galaxy map of where you think that you just went, You'd have to be a super nerd who's already read it and already known it from a previous set of comic books or television shows or whatever to know where the heck you are. And there are people that do that, and that's great. But now let's talk about the number of characters. How many of you saw the original Iron Man? And then how many of you saw the Avenger series? There's a big difference, isn't there? Robert Downey Jr. gets massive screen time in Iron Man. But when it goes over to Avengers, I think his agent actually negotiated that he got something like 25% airtime or something like that. Some number. And everyone else had to share the rest of the airtime. Oh, what if you're a big Chris Hemsworth Thor fan, or you're any one of these characters? You love them. But your character's not getting much screen time. So you kind of like it, and you're kind of like, well, you know, I guess I had to share my time for my character with all these other characters. Because of the fact that the main thing that you need to accomplish in any script that you write, any story that you write, is that you have to make the audience care. Again, what's amazing, if you admit to anyone you're a writer, you'll get people that say, oh man, I got a movie idea. And you're like, okay, go ahead, because they want to tell you. And they give you a premise, and they even name off some characters sometimes. You know, they got maybe like 30% of the game worked out to even get started writing anything down on paper. And the one thing that I typically run into is that even after they talk about all this stuff that they think is great, they'll have some big explosion scenes that Michael Bay could do really well. You don't care. You don't care about what it is. How does someone care about a character? By reducing the amount of ancillary characters to your main protagonist, your main antagonist, you get to build up the two folks that are gonna go at it. Now, just to clarify, in case someone is splitting hairs whilst listening to this, you might say, well, hey, in A New Hope, Darth Vader was seldom alone in a room. He was with a ton of people. And you're not wrong, of course, but now write down how many people spoke. He's in that conference room where he chokes out the dude for insulting his tired old religion. Well, obviously, I think most of us realize that that scene was created to establish a command structure for Darth Vader, Tarkin, and anyone else that's part of the Imperial Force. It was actually the first time that when we were watching this movie, we see Darth Vader, you know, roll into that Corvette spaceship at the very opening scene where he's coming to find the plans, and Princess Leia's in there and giving it to R2-D2, and then they jettison out in a escape capsule. So here he is, OG pimp, baddest bad guy in any movie ever created in the history of human storytelling. And now you see him in a conference room. And it appears that even in his formidable presence, where everyone else was, you know, peeing their pants, this one guy's lipping off to him. Even Tarkin told him to stop choking the guy out. Oh my gosh. So one of the most powerful people in this entire film isn't perceivably the most powerful person in that world. Then we get to Return of the Jedi, we then discover that there's an emperor. And that makes more sense to us because this dude's like, you know, he's a full-blown wizard, man. And then we lose that other reporting structure telling Darth Vader what to do. Remember all the moments when he's, you know, giving commands and choking people out left and right? So they decided to go ahead and elevate him in the next film such that he is 100% in charge, unless the Emperor wants something otherwise. Him kneeling and reporting into the Emperor was amazing, because just seeing Darth Vader kneel after two films of building that one guy up with lots of screen time, because there's not too many characters in this film, we understood what that meant. That dude he's kneeling to, which I believe at first we don't know exactly what he looks like and all this other stuff. We get these sort of weird impressions. And of course, they went through a few iterations about what he actually looked like. It's powerful. With Star Wars 1, you have this character played by Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker. And what was brilliant about that film is that, what's not brilliant about that film, but Mark Hamill took a lot of grief over the decades following the series, and that I even had a friend of mine say, I didn't really like Star Wars that much. And I said, really? Why? Because, Luke Skywalker's this whiny little kid. I just hate hearing that whiny thing. And that's exactly how he was told to behave. That's exactly how he was written. Because if you start him off a super badass guy in Tatooine, where can you take that character? If he's super badass in Return of the Jedi, then he's been the same character the entire time. They had to mature him over time, which was what we call a maturation script. But just remember him arguing with his uncle. He wants to go off and see his buddies, and there's plenty of time for that later, And then he's kind of pissed, and he's working on the robots. And we see this super sweet nature to him. He's being nice to inanimate objects, which are robots. When he sees Princess Leia projected on the floor, he is just mesmerized as a young man who has seen the most beautiful girl he's ever seen in his life. When he goes and sees and finds Obi-Wan Kenobi, and he sits there, and Obi-Wan's talking about his dad and the Clone Wars and all this stuff, shows him a lightsaber for the first time. He's being mentored. We feel it. But if it was today's script, it would be 20 other characters before this would happen. Just remembering what happens in the previous scene starts to become a daunting thing. We have about a 30-digit phone number we have to remember now. What's really interesting is I think that Hollywood has lost the capability, and I shouldn't say Hollywood, it's probably more the audience, to allow a script to build up. When I handed my first version of Cú Chulainn to Hemsworth, he was flying to London to film Rush. And apparently his first comment back to our mutual buddy was, doesn't look like I got too many lines at the beginning, in this film until, he was speaking in his character by page 5. The problem is that he's a little boy. We have to figure out why Jesus was born on Earth, which is Cú Chulainn's story, 2500 BC. There's a reason why he was brought into this world. Now, I rewrote it to have a little bit of a fight scene at the beginning that then flashes backwards. I give a moment where he's thinking, oh my gosh, who am I? Just to make sure he gets lines in the first page. But it was interesting. So many great films start off so slow. But if you're going to tell a story of a child growing up to be a hero, well, you're going to have to show the child part in flashbacking simply because the actor might be a little bit of a narcissist at the time, injures the overall storytelling process, in my opinion. And I think that one of the things that I've noticed in writers that people I've talked to and maybe mentored, I guess, is probably an advanced word for the real contribution that I gave. But when you don't realize that it's a marathon and not a sprint, one of the classic things you'll do if you're starting off screenwriting is you'll move so quickly into the action. And you might have absolutely perfect scenes. Your writing isn't bad, your idea isn't bad, your premise isn't bad. You really do have people where you want them. But they'll get to about page 45 to 50, somewhere in there, and they have exhausted all their ideas. And now they have this giant chasm they have to leap from. I write in a four-act system, so they're in the middle of Act 2, and they need to get all the way to Act 4, but they've burned all their stuff. Because they overcomplicated their script. They consumed things too quickly. They sprinted, and now they're out of wind. Think about movies like Back to the Future. if I said, what are the sets and the famous locations in the first film, which were then lovingly recreated in the second film, which I think is a masterpiece. You've got the parking lot where they hit 88 miles an hour and went to the past. They have that clock tower. How famous was the clock tower? Once you rewatch the movie a second time, third time, and then the 100th time, you realize the clock tower is in the first shot when they get back to the 50s. You have that diner where he's trying to tell his dad how to say destiny, you know? There are very few places. The Doc's house, which is a house up in Pasadena. These places become endearing locations in your memory. It wasn't by mistake. And so once you realize it's intentional and it actually simplifies your task for writing a script, it really simplifies things for you. Now, I hope it goes without saying that if you start in a simplistic foundation, you've got perhaps, let's say, five key locations with two fairly important ancillary locations. So we're up to seven now. So the brain can completely understand those locations and memorize them and make them endearing. If you needed more, you now can take a step back and realize, okay, if I'm going to introduce an eighth location, one, the question the writer always has to ask is why? Is it truly that important to the script? Because simplifying things is the name of the game. Every word should be cut that could be cut. Every scene should be cut unless it has a profound meaning. Of course, the kiss of death is folks that fall in love with scenes that were sort of the catalyst of writing the script. Because they feel like, man, if I hadn't thought of this particular scene, the entire movie wouldn't exist in my mind. So therefore, to pay homage to this scene I saw, I'm going to keep it in there. You got to get rid of it. It'll just be exhibition unless something's turning. Or someone grows, someone changes, something happens. And a switch is flicked, the cogwheel turns. Mandalorian is keeping things very linear. Very simple. It's reusing planets. It's reusing characters. You look forward to Mandalorian visiting Tatooine, the bay where he lands his vehicle, which is the same base that the Millennium Falcon used to land in. And there's a woman in there who's a mechanic who runs all these little robots that fix his ship. And she's in love with the baby Yoda. We had her established in season one, and she's in the opening episode of season two. And the funny thing is that they probably just threw her in there to perform a small function in season one, found out that she was a very talented actress. The dialogue they wrote for her really read well. And so why not pull her back and have her say something like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm so nervous with you having this little kid with you because I think he might get hurt. And then she immediately treats Baby Yoda like a baby. He doesn't do that as much. He lets the little tyke, who's probably 50 years old, defend himself and kind of keep himself out of trouble to the best of his ability until things get super duper hot. And then, of course, he steps in, which makes that special. The thing that I found, because I want to switch to a few comments about Game of Thrones, and for those of you who love Game of Thrones, I understand you love it, and you got it, and you understood it. I have seen, I guess, about 70% of that series, because I don't own it. I don't even know what service is on. My buddy bought it, and so we've just rattled through his DVDs, or Blu-rays, or whatever. But I found that the character count was epic. I mean, it was huge. There's so many families and cliques and sects and factions that you start to, well, especially if you watch it like I did, which is someone put in the fourth Blu-ray, or fourth season first. So we were totally confused what the hell we were watching. That was just a mistake. So dialing back was a little bit difficult. So I have a little anomaly with my understanding of what was going on. But I probably got through the last three seasons pretty linearly. I never cared about the characters at all. Every single character was a flavor of a backstabbing person. So for me, just looking at it, I'm sitting there thinking about the audience that would get into this, and I'm thinking, wow, you have to be sort of a bunch of like sycophants for sadists, you know, to really get into this. Where is there anyone that has any virtue? They only have virtue from the perspective of what's going on in the story, which it's obviously masterfully written. Production value was beyond anything I'd seen before on television. But it really, when it came down to it, it was a vehicle for special effects. Until perhaps maybe the last two episodes, where the two brothers kind of told each other how much they love each other in their own little way. And perhaps that happened earlier and I missed it. I know a lot of people disappeared, I guess, during the dinner sequence, which I am yet to see in full. I think one of the reasons why this classic writing style is starting to become very popular is that it never was really unpopular. It's just Hollywood changed the way that they started buying films from writers. They went from reading every single script that people were mailing in to the studios to rejecting all the scripts that ever sent in and getting it straight out of the agencies who have a limited capacity to process scripts. About 10 years ago, the word on the street was nobody reads anything. You better put together a treatment for your script, which is, it's about 15 pages, about five business pages of, you know, your quick pitch, who you think might be in the film, breaking down demographics and sort of your approach, establishing what your film is like, meaning Star Wars meets Ghostbusters, you know, that kind of thing. And then a 10-page, extremely abbreviated, double-spaced version of your entire film. And that better be gripping, man. Then if they get through your treatment, they're willing to read your script. I think in recent years, at least in my experience, they're reading now. They're reading the whole thing. But they have limited time. Think about Stranger Things. Stranger Things is the epitome of scene redundancy, character redundancy, and it works. Everyone's home. You know their homes. You know the basement where they play Dungeons and Dragons. You now know the malls they go to, the schools they go to, the cars that they drive. I mean, you know, the sheriff drove the pickup. Winona Ryder drove that, I think, a station wagon. Little tiny one. You know. And when you see those vehicles, think about it. How many times have you taken a trivia test? I had a buddy of mine who's an amazing 3D artist, an artist in general. He did a little thing over the summer, which was really cool. He picked every famous television and movie vehicle. So like the Ghostbusters car, Knight Rider, all these, like all the Bumblebees, all these cars from all these different locations. And he had a big tournament of us voting through Instagram on what car was better than the other car down to a final. And I picked the car that won on the first day, which is Back to the Future. But think about it. Back to the Future is not about a car. But that car became so famous and such an enabling vehicle to make this movie possible that people build replicates of the car all the time. The Ghostbusters car. Is it really like Grease Lightning in Grease? No. It's just in a few shots in any one of the movies. But it is so famous because it was so well designed for that script. You remembered it. Now, what if Ghostbusters had, you know, 20 cop cars that were converted? Nobody would remember the cars. Now, with Knight Rider, it was the car. Kit, you know, come over to me, and Kit did a bunch of cool stuff and was integrated into the story as an AI car. When you think about your characters, especially if you read all the books on how to write a film, you'll get a lot of formulaic stuff, which is actually 100% true, but it's not really... I put it this way. When you read what you're supposed to do with a character, it's not always obvious once you leave your main characters as to how to develop other characters. Meaning, let's use Back to the Future for a split second. You've got Marty, who's Michael J. Fox's character, and then you have that Biff character, which the name I forget his the actor's name, but Biff is this crazy antagonist. As soon as he gets to the past, he is the reason why it's difficult to get done what he needs to get done. Because in addition to trying to find his parents and trying to fix the photograph and all this stuff, he's got this guy after him constantly. The big thing, instead of them telling you stories or telling you little idealistic statements like, you must write a really interesting character, you know, and blah, blah, blah about their dimensions and their little idiosyncrasies, what I find a lot easier for my brain is answering a couple questions. What's the purpose of this character in your film? Now, there's a real clinical one. Well, he's the brother or something or whatever. He's just the guy who doesn't like the main character. But the easier question to ask is, what would make the audience remember this character? What is it that makes you go, oh, yeah, that guy? From that point forward, it will it'll help you answer a lot of other questions. We all know that memorable characters usually speak in a certain way. With Biff, he was constantly messing up a bunch of classic phrases. Make like a leaf and get out of here. You know, I mean, all kinds of weird stuff. In 2010 in Space Odyssey, they had a Russian that was always going, it's a piece of pie. It's easy as cake. And you get messing these things up. You could do that. You could take Pinhead from the Hellraiser series. Every time that guy opened his mouth, it was as if he was reading the creed from the devil himself. Morbius in Forbidden Planet. The dude was a PhD linguist before he took a 300% mind booster. And now he's going to talk. Okay, so he understands the human or English language better than most people on planet Earth. And now he's augmented his IQ 300%. So have fun writing that guy's dialogue. But they did it. If you watch the film, you will immediately recognize that every word that he spoke was carefully chosen. And because they hired Walter Pidgeon to play the character, who's already this extremely amazing, like King Arthur kind of character, swashbuckling guy, his voice has just got a boom, you know, I mean, it's like mini tremors every time the guy talks. And then they gifted him with this dialogue that he just perfectly delivered. If you go back to Star Wars for a split second, you've got some interesting, like, elasticity to Luke Skywalker's character. He doesn't really want to do anything that takes effort because that's a young quality that just exists in young people. I want to do that. Oh, my God, I got to do that. You know, Yoda's like, hey, lift that thing out of the swamp. Oh, I can't do that. Oh, God, you know, and then Yoda's like, let me show this is done. Boom, and he pulls it out. Darth Vader. Listen to the charter of his dialogue. That dude is like, let's get it done. Let's get it done. Let's get it done. I'm not here on this spaceship for any other reason than to get things done. He was a statistician, man. If he felt the force, you know, man, I haven't felt this for a long time. And then he's like, that feels like, and he just walks off camera. You know, we know that he was feeling Obi-Wan Kenobi. We know. Imagine a villain like that coming after you. Now, we have meticulous villains like that where Darth Vader, you know, I mean, at one point he's like sister, you know, and he realizes that Luke is talking to his sister, calling her from, I think, Cloud City. And he's like, oh my gosh, I got another kid. Didn't even know about it. And then you can have sort of supernatural characters like Michael Myers from Halloween, who just is eerie as hell because the guy can do magical things. When Jamie Lee Curtis is running from the guy, you know, he's in the garage and she locks the door and padlocks it 10 times. And he's just her brother who escaped out of an insane asylum, who's coming back for some fun. And then she'll run upstairs and he's already in the master bedroom. You know, it's like some magical teleportation. It's unexplained. But that's why we get goosebumps when we see that burned off William Shatner mask he's wearing. So depending on the overall physics of your universe as to what is possible and what is not possible, this is where you can make really fun choices. One of the things I learned from George Lucas in interviews that he had taken, I'm not even sure where I saw these, and it's a very basic low-hanging fruit statement for professional writers, but you have to define your universe. You have to define what's possible. I give an example of how you've probably noticed this, because Star Wars is a very old franchise. In the first movie that was released, the amount of force that was available was very, very limited. By the time the first scene happens in Empire Strikes Back, where Luke is attacked by some snow beast, and he's hanging upside down with his feet frozen into the ceiling, which is just a cool idea. And he's got his lightsaber over there, and he can't quite get it. And then we see him close his eyes and rattle that thing out of the snow. And here comes the beast. They have the suspense compacting on your brain. He's stuck. The beast is coming. He's hungry. He's going to eat Luke. And Luke's just like, God dang it, let me just get that thing out of the ground. And then poof, he gets the thing, cuts himself loose, cuts off the dude's arm or whatever the hell he did, and he got out of there. Okay, well, what happens by the time the finale scene of Return of the Jedi happens? Now they're hurling containers at each other. I mean, the force is like limitless. What makes it make sense is that we saw it through the maturation plot of Luke Skywalker. We saw him learn all of these things, and as he learned these things and got himself in more tumultuous situations with more masters, his father and the Emperor, it made sense because Obi-Wan was out at the end of the first film. And Obi-Wan was trying to protect Luke from getting too close to this whole thing because he knows his old man is Darth Vader, but he's not telling him. So ratcheting up the Force was actually well within the realm of what George laid down. Now, I'm sure in real life, they just kept developing it in their mind, but it all worked out in the end perfectly. In today's film writing, you would have to have that last scene in the third trilogy be the opening scene in the first movie, thus blowing your wad, sprinting, and running out of material. We, as an audience, went to Dagobah. We, as an audience, were running with Luke, with Yoda on the back, going through all the trials in the cave, the TIE fighter in the swamp. We got to see all that stuff. So we went on the journey as well. Remember that as you choose your universe, as you choose your storytelling elements. I'm going to tell you this. If you can just think of your life, think of a year like a dollar bill. And every day, you're spending a bit of that dollar bill. And you know that at the end of the year, the dollar bill's gone. And you have to come up with another buck to go into the next year. If you want to be a professional writer, you're going to have to do everything you possibly can to speed up your writing and to make sure that what you're writing is entertaining anyone who's gifting you with their time to read your script. And you're going to get better and better. Every script gets better in different ways. I change genres completely between scripts. But now, imagine you limit things like I'm saying. You limit the number of characters. You limit the number of sets. Star Trek is another great series to watch, even from the 60s all the way up to 2005 when Enterprise was abruptly canceled, which was a great series. You know, you got the bridge, you got the medical bay, engineering. I mean, it's just a few places, you know, people's, you know, Picard's little apartment. And you just, it's, people live inside the Enterprise in their brain because it was easy to understand all these locations. Plus, they have 26 episodes a season to develop them. But now, if you keep your character list short and your setting list short, think about all the other time you have in your dollar to spend on the characters and to spend on those sets to make them even more meaningful and endearing to the viewer. So you can achieve more story quality, in my opinion, the more that you limit sort of things that are just going to cause you problems in the end in the first place. I like to write from time to time mysteries, no matter what genre. It could be sci-fi mystery, it could be horror mystery, whatever. But I like to write lots of cluing and twists that really pay off. Well, if you really want to set up a clue payoff or a twist payoff, then you have to expose to the listener a blatant clue in the very beginning that without other information that's about to come, they let that clue go right through their head. They heard it, but they didn't hear it, right? Maybe, what is it? They listened, but they didn't hear. And so when they get to rewatch the film, they realize I actually gave them the information that if they were super autistic, they could have figured it out, or at least installed the suspicion. Well, that was a weird statement. Let me put that in the back of my head. And then when it pays off, it feels wonderful. Give an example. I've been marathoning Twilight Zones, like I said. Yesterday, I saw the episode where the woman is in her apartment. The world is, in this particular world, in this particular set, is slowly closing its orbital loop with the sun, and so it's getting really, really hot on Earth. She's in New York City. There's an old woman next door, and they're kind of rationing their water. Everyone's sweating everywhere they are. And she says to the old lady at the beginning, because they're just like, oh my gosh, this is, you know, how much time do we have left before we just get burned up on Earth? And she says to the old woman at the very beginning of the episode, I just can't shake this feeling that this is all just a bad dream and I'm just going to wake up from it. Now, that's a statement that is said in life about situations. Either you have a wonderful situation going, you're like, oh my God, just pinch me because this is such an amazing situation. Or you're in a tumultuous situation and you're like, oh my God, please tell me this is just a nightmare. I'm going to wake up from it. You've heard it in 1,000 scripts where it was never a payoff. At the end of this Twilight Zone, was it 22 minutes in or whatever, she ends up passing out and she wakes up in the same exact apartment, except it's really cold outside, and people are, the old woman is actually there helping her with her fever. And she wakes up and it's nice and cold or cool in the apartment, and she's got blankets on. She's like, oh my gosh, you wouldn't believe it. I just had this horrible, you know, nightmare that I was in this, you know, really hot world, and the world was going to burn up in the sun, and oh my gosh, I'm so glad to be here. Well, the world that she woke up in, and the twist at the end, hate to ruin this for you, but you've probably already seen it, and if you care, was that they're in an opposite world. The world is actually falling away from the sun, and everyone's going to freeze to death. And that's the world that she wakes up in, the opposite polarity of the opening scene. But she gave you the clue at the very, very beginning. How many sets did they have? Technically one, her apartment. They filmed outside the in the hallway for a split second for a new character that was coming to their location. And they said goodbye to a neighbor, I think, out in the hallway as well. But if you look at most of the Twilight Zones, 190 of them, man, they have these very simple sets of characters, very simple set counts, because they have 22 minutes to finish this thing. And if you're like me, one of the most endearing things about watching a Twilight Zone are all these locations. You sort of want to visit some of them. You want to be in some of the sets. And because they reused a bunch of locations for the city and for the neighborhoods, you'll see replicant houses. You know, you see the same house used for two or three different episodes. So as a body of work, it also has that feel. Well, what do you think Mandalorian's doing? Mandalorian has Tatooine, man. Isn't that cool? You get to go back to A New Hope. And of course, Tatooine was reused in the latest films. Didn't feel anything like Tatooine, in my opinion. But Mandalorian, it's so true to the original movies that Favreau should have written the sequels. He should have. If any of you watched Rogue One and appreciated that film, well, it has a lot of sets, a lot of locations. And so, even though it's a really good film, you're in places you don't have any attachment to. When that scene happens where the, I think it was the, Star Destroyer or something, sent that beam down and blew up that city, which is one of the most amazing special effects I've ever seen of its kind. Your mind's blowing because of the special effects. But you're not mourning the death of all those people, necessarily. Or if you do, the depth of which you are mourning their deaths is limited, because that's not where the cantina is. That's not where Obi-Wan Kenobi's crib is. I mean, they're not destroying priceless relics of the story franchise. Had they had the guts to do that, man, that would have been rough. If you ever see in any future episode that little Tatooine city get destroyed, you realize that your whole childhood just got destroyed. But just take inventory of the movies that you love that perhaps are not inside action genres, because action genres tend to have a requirement to really change locations quite a bit. You'll find out that they limited everything. There's episodes of Star Trek where they're giving the rest of the crew a vacation. Like, take this week off, guys. We're going to rotate through so everyone gets some time off. And it'll be a little episode where Picard and Wesley Crusher are stuck in a vehicle freezing to death, you know, or something. They're off on some little adventure, and it's mostly about them, thus giving anyone who's not on screen a week off. It works. It's totally a gripping episode. And I just want to kind of, I guess, the epilogue to this episode is something like the following. Anytime that you have a talent, now forget screenwriting for a split second. Let's say you have a talent. There's just an infinite amount of talents. Let's say you know how to fix a car. You know how to tell a computer what to do in a particular realm. To you, it's easy. It wasn't easy probably when you were learning it. Although if it's your God-given talent, it is easy. Somehow when you play a guitar solo or a song on a guitar and the whole family's going, wow, isn't that amazing? I don't know how to do anything on that thing. And you're like, wow, it's not that hard, you know? You want screenwriting to be that easy for you. But because storytelling, good storytelling, is and coming from an original location in your storytelling, not stealing other people's scripts and just, you know, rewriting them, there's a place for that as well. But when you really demand, like I demand all my stories be 1,000% original, that's already going to kick your butt. That regiment's already going to be really, really tough. So you don't want the mechanism underneath what you're trying to do to be difficult. So you need to do everything in your power to come up with your formula for how to write a script quickly if you have, to the degree you have things figured out. And all my episodes have been aimed at getting rid of the mechanic underneath. And I can't recommend Robert McKee's book Story and his in-person lectures enough. If you're serious about this, find out where that guy's teaching. We're not going to have him on this planet forever. He's an extremely engaging teacher. And the way that I tell people to process his book, which I suggest, unless you're a big reader and you love to read as a form of ingesting information, I recommend getting his book on tape if you can only do that, because he reads the book to you and you'll hear his voice. He will, you need to go into his works with your script idea and pretend like he's talking to you the entire time about your script. I've taken his intro class twice, and when I was going into his second session of his first class, I had Ku Klan going in my head, and so I was using everything he said on my characters. And my gosh, stuff started falling out of me that I never thought would just fall out of me so easily. And I'm going to give you a really esoteric statement or suggestion here if you run into any writer's block. I was at a smoke lounge in San Jose, of all places. I was up there for business. A buddy of mine, who was my agent, he said, "You got to go here. Just to smoke cigars. It's this little house. It's really cool." Anyway, I'm talking to this guy who's a very successful marketing dude. Doesn't do scripts at all. And he had suggested this app on my phone to help me focus, because he uses it. It's called Brain.fm. It's a Brain period FM. I think it's easily on Android and iOS. And he talked about it. It's a sympathetic harmony application. So it puts one frequency in your left ear and another frequency in your right ear. You have to use earbuds to use it. And your brain modulates a third frequency in the center. So they use this sort of technology that's weapon technology to help you out, to give you the type of emotions and feelings that you want to have. And I was writing Ku Klan at the time. And I knew that I had to have two characters fight each other. It was going to be the pinnacle moment where this character I had invented, who was definitely in a fight scene at the very beginning, but he had a machine around him to help him fight. But he also seemed to be very into knives and like butcher knives and stuff. He had like two giant butcher knives on his chest. And he's kind of the thief kind of character. But through a chain of events, he actually turns his loyalty from against Ku Klan to totally mind blown by Ku Klan, because he was in a scene where Ku Klan's godlike status was validated by another god right in front of his eyes. And so we're in the fourth act, the closing act of the script, and there's a moment where I needed a group of soldiers that was protecting the queen to be eliminated. And I thought, okay, I'm God, so I can do anything I want in this script, right? And so I said, let's make a backstory between this dude with these knives on his chest and the head dude down there who's telling the guards what to do. Like, they're old, kind of like former buddies, and now they hate each other. And there's a bunch of backstory that could be pulled out. But for the life of me, I couldn't figure out how this scene would work. It just didn't play in my brain. And so I'm like, oh man, there was that Brain FM app that he suggested. And so I put the earbuds, I'm like sitting right over there. It was a hot summer day. I put these earbuds in and I dial up creativity, and you can cycle through the music that you listen to. So if the music that they're using to get these frequencies in your brain is not aligned with whatever you're doing, you just hit next and it just scrambles the music until you get the track you like. And I just so happened to find a perfect track on the first attempt. It was unbelievable. I'm sitting there dead. And I push play, and within, I don't know, 5 seconds, no kidding, this thing just absolutely hit me I was seeing the scene, and I was trying to write as fast as I possibly could to get the key sequences. It wasn't even like screenwriting. It was just bullet point writing, you know, like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And then I polished it all up, and it turned out to be the perfect pinnacle moment of this dude. He showed all of his skill sets, the backstory that just flew out of the character's mouth. I mean, they were living by themselves. I was just sitting there just hovering, you know, writing down what was going on. And that probably, believe it or not, links back to the simplicity algorithm, which is that thing I've mentioned before, and there's a Twilight Zone on this too. It's the one where the guy talks into the recorder and he can conjure up his characters in real life. He always conjures up this woman named Mary who makes him cocktails. And his wife sees this woman through the window and is like, what the hell? So she comes storming in and he's like, he gets rid of her somehow. You don't know how he gets rid of her. And then she's looking around the room and she's trying to play coy. You know, she's like, oh, you know, are you here by yourself? What's going on in here? You know, and he's like, you're back early. Did you not watch the movie? No, I didn't watch the movie anyway. Do you have like a secret door in here that you can, you know, come in and out of? He's like, well, no, why would I have a secret door? When she finally pins him down and he slips up in speech and admits that Mary exists, because she's calling her a tramp. The wife is calling her a tramp or something, you know, like a common woman. And he defends her instinctively. And then she's looking at him like, oh, so she does exist, you know? He then tries to explain to his wife what's going on. And so he says, honey, do you remember what I told you? That I wrote that one book that made me a lot of money, and I told you that that character was, you know, living his own life inside my mind. And then he says, well, you know, I dictated a description of him in this recorder, and he walked into this room. Now, I'll let it sit there in terms of the episode. You can watch it if you want to see it. It's one of the most endearing episodes. In fact, it's the only episode I'm aware of that Rod Serling himself becomes a character inside the actual Twilight Zone. But he's absolutely positively correct, and it's a super strange thing that happens when you attach to your characters really well. And the reason why I'm mentioning this now is that if you simplify your script, thus giving yourself more money in your dollar to spend on each one of your characters, there is this, somehow there's a threshold where the character goes from something that you have to constantly puppet inside your mind. You put your hand in there and you say, this character is saying this, this character is saying that. And then at some point, I don't know what it is, there's a threshold you cross and the character is actually living inside your head. Like you have a personality that's been created. What's interesting about it is if you have sort of an existential view of the universe, and again, if you're not familiar with this show, you just stumbled into the episode, this might seem really strange, but go ahead and watch a few episodes or go to deepthoughtsradio.com and find the categories that are on these sorts of things. If you believe that we're in a matrix, for instance, then it's like the person really exists up there as a programmer or something, or someone is, the story's been written a long time ago and you're simply bringing it into this particular instance of the universe. And so they're reading you the script, or they are those characters. You're telling their life story from a different universe and they're just controlling your mind. They're just, you know, dictating and arguing with you. That's the thing. When your characters argue with you, you know, you're there. If you just believe in souls and a universe, maybe it's one of the other spirits that has lived this life and or have written the story, or, you know, can you imagine? I'm just going to go off because I got about 10 minutes here. Imagine a situation where all of the stories that we ever tell are real stories that really happened at some point in the universe, parallel universe, your universe. And maybe what you're doing is you're projecting your mind into that other universe and simply listening to it. But when they start to argue with you, what's really, really strange is that, one, the character becomes real in your mind inside the character envelope that you've created, meaning they're not standing there as an actor telling you that you're writing their lines incorrectly. They're standing there as the actual character saying, nah, that's not what happened in my life story. This, and they take the attitude that's like, you're telling my life story. So you're writing my autobiography, you're writing my biography, excuse me, and you're doing it wrong. But what's interesting is the last time I had this happen, I've told this story before, I was writing the Tron 3, and I created this character that I just was in love with. He was this endearing kind of nerdy character in the posse that was following Sam into the system. And not to ruin it for you, because it'll never be made, especially since the actor who plays Sam just got a DUI. But he was saying, you know, I got to die, right? At one point. And it took me completely off guard. I hadn't even considered killing this guy. I don't even know if I'd gotten to a point where I'd realized, yeah, some of the heroes have to die, because that's just what these kind of movies do. And he's going, hey, you know, pick me, pick me. And I'm like, what do you want? I got to die. And I'm sitting there arguing with that character. And I'm telling you the 100% truth. I think the estimated time I argued with this character was 2 weeks. And finally, I think that he just kind of said, you know, shh, and grabbed me and pulled me into the film and said, shut up and just watch this scene and tell me how you feel and tell me that you don't want your audience to feel this way. And he showed me how he died. And man, I got verklempt, man. I was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? And my girlfriend, I was telling her, I was telling her, it was 2015. I was telling her all those scenes up to that point, you know, just telling her where I was going with stuff. And so she was very familiar with this character. And so we're eating sushi one night. And I said, you know, that character, told me he needed to die. And so I told her the sequence of events, and she totally teared up. She put her hand on her chest like, oh my God. And I was like, wow, that's it. That's a gold mine of a scene that's going to pay off for the audience just like that. And what was interesting was, is I was sort of in it was about the 30-minute gap between the middle of Act 3 and the beginning of Act 4. And so there was sort of like, I know what technically needs to occur as a bunch of technical events that need to occur, but I didn't know exactly what the characters would be doing that would be interesting. After the dude showed me the scene, I immediately had another character sacrifice himself, which will just kill you, and then we're down two, everyone's hurting. And so we got to take the pressure off. You can't do a bunch of those in a row, right? And then I pushed it into Act 4, and it all worked out perfectly. If you're like me, you'll be developing probably 3 scripts at once. One you're actively writing. One you're getting ready to write. And what that means is you're getting really ready to get into your screenwriting software. As soon as you're done writing the one you're working on, you can immediately switch to the next one. And the third one, you're still developing. You got more of a premise than a story, and you're still trying to figure out your locations, your characters, and what the heck is going to make anyone care about your story and remember your characters. If you allow it to be too ad hoc, in my opinion, now we're all different, and writers will argue like crazy about techniques, and if you've got a way, you shouldn't be listening to me. If you're successfully writing, it's probably a detriment that you hear my opinion, unless somehow from the first word I said, I'm complimenting your techniques and you're finding within minutes things that will align with your method of writing. But if you're already successful writing, I probably should have said this at the beginning, but you shouldn't listen to anyone else. Screw everybody else. You do what works for you. But if you're getting involved, which is what my episodes are based on, is you're interested in doing this, you've always thought about doing this, but it always seems just daunting. Keeping it simple is the golden rule, at least at the beginning. You make it difficult later on in life. And that'll be your secret sauce that makes someone read your script in such a way that they'll just know who wrote it without a credit on the front. Or if they skip the front page and they don't figure out who wrote the script, they'll just, oh, this is in Tarantino's script. I can always sense a Tarantino script. What's really nice about this is that regardless of what's going on in the world, when you write, you create your own world. And if you can successfully entertain yourself from start to finish, guess what? You've created an experience that people will pay for to get out of this world for a little while, a little escapism. If you write meaningful stuff, it doesn't matter what genre, you can write a goofy cartoon. You can make people think about cartoons and their life as a guiding force. I think Bug's Life will always travel with me. The few grasshoppers telling the ants what to do. And it's only because the ants agree to it that that power is even capable of being there. But there's also something else about being creative that I think is extremely important. Too many people believe that they're not creative. And, you know, one of the key signs that you can tell people, and I've shared this story a lot with, I think a couple times for you guys, but it's a good little reminder. Sometimes you'll have someone tell you how non-creative they are. And if you are creative, it's sort of a weird thing. Really? How do you know you're not creative? You know, they'll tell you they're not creative, but then they'll say things like this. Well, you want to watch this movie? It'll be a horror movie. Not a gross, ridiculous, you know, Saw movie, but something with like The Shining or something that's going to really make you think, and or a zombie show on TV. I had a girlfriend that couldn't watch zombie films. She happens to be creative, but I found people that say they're not creative and they can't watch a zombie film. And I'll say, why can't you watch a scary film in general? Well, because it gives me nightmares and I think about it and I'm like, What that means to me is that they're extremely creative. They're going to go to bed and they're going to walk around in life imagining things that don't exist. They're going to take the story where it ended on TV and they're going to continue writing the story in their life, freaking themselves out. That is creativity. But they have told themselves that they're not creative. Now, here's the thing. I think a lot of you are probably really creative. We have so many musicians and artists and I was going to say musicians twice. We just have a lot of amazing people that share their stuff. Once you get into this creative thing, you'll start to feel the harmony of the universe and your soul sing a song to the point where you're not even working. It is such a gifted feeling that is sort of, you know, it's funny. We know that we have pleasure zones attached to procreation because it was very important that whoever designed us made that pleasurable because that's our keystone to existing in this universe, right? Well, the other thing that you'll find when you're creative is that there's this resonating crystal in you that harmonizes with the universe the second you start to create something. And I think it's there as an intellectual process of doing what you're supposed to be doing on this planet, being creative. Now, you can be creative a million different ways. You can be creative accounting. Sometimes that's bad. But you can do anything creative. Write an algorithm that's creative. So it doesn't have to be anything that's like Hollywood creative. But whatever you do, do it with style. Do it with some expression if you can. Do it such that when your peers review what you did, they're like, wow, that was really cool. Anyway, hope that you dug this episode. That'll be a nice break from all the other heavy topics that are going on. If you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please understand that there's a website out there. No matter where we get banned or whatever, there's always BitChute that will back us up on the video side. I'm going to be exploring some new channels. I don't even want to say their names yet because I don't know if they can take a two-hour upload without charging me money. And so just go there for everything. There's a whole section on screenwriting. I think this will be about the 9th episode on screenwriting, somewhere in there. So if you want to get more information about this from me, that's where you can get a bunch of different analyses of the situation. But we have two video links, two audio links. We have the social media, which currently is just Facebook and Minds.com. Minds.com is a duplicate of Facebook, except that they don't censor you. And then we have an all-new remastered season one. We have a store. And we have a couple ways to donate to the show, Patreon and PayPal. And for everybody who contributes there, thank you so much. You made this whole season possible. Trust me. Anyway, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.